Okay, I'm wearing two mics. I'm not sure which one is working. Hopefully I sound okay there. Well, thank you so much. It's really, really rewarding to see so many people in this room today. My job today is to walk you through the code process and where we're at currently, how the process works, where we need to go for the future, and I think I'll be ending off with a little bit of a challenge for everyone as well. So my slides seem to be advancing on their own. So codes are, and they really need to be, our national understanding of farmed animal care requirements and recommended best practices. They do need to be scientifically informed, practical, because if they aren't practical and implementable, then really what's the point? And they need to reflect societal expectations for responsible farmed animal care. And they need to do all these things because the codes play a really big role in Canada. They really are the foundation of everything we do relative to farmed animal care and welfare. So it's very important that everyone has a say and that everyone buys into the codes. The codes serve primarily as education tools, and that's been their role. That was their role when they were originally envisioned. And I think that continues to be their primary and most important role. I've been to a number of conferences of late where research has been going on in terms of how do we do information extension and what is the best way to improve animal welfare on farm. And in fact, it is effective information extension that is the number one way to reach out to the majority of animal users out there and is the number one way to assure good animal care. It's not regulation, and it's not even assessment programs. It's information extension. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that that is going to reach the majority of people and be the most effective tool we have, because the majority of people do want to do the right thing. However, codes are also being used as reference materials for regulation for those where information extension maybe doesn't work so well. And it seems to be increasingly happening across Canada, and many provinces are specifically referencing the codes in their provincial welfare regulations. And as Robin mentioned, codes are becoming the foundation for animal care assessment programs. Those commodity groups that have already gone down that road have used the codes as their basis, and the animal care assessment model as it evolves. I think I'm starting to sound more clear now. Feeling better to me as well. I felt like I was talking into a bubble. The animal care assessment model will be used as a mechanism for demonstrating adherence to the code as well. Now, I'm trying to advance. Am I doing the advancing or is someone else advancing for me? There we go. No, that one's not different.
It's not as easy as it looks.
It's not. It's actually very hard. All right, I'll try maybe push harder on the button. So we've had codes for a very long time. I think everyone in this room pretty much knows that. When NFAC was created in 2005, we were given the mandate to reestablish the codes, the code development process. And so when we first started down that path, the first question we asked was, do we even need codes? Have they done their time? And I remember talking with David Fraser about this, and I don't know if he remembers making this comment, but he had said to me, you know, codes were good for the 80s, and they're still good for the 80s. And the message there was that they really needed to be updated to reflect the demands that were being placed on them, and they needed to meet current expectations. And so that's what we worked very hard at doing on the code process, ensuring that there are clear linkages between what the recommendations and the requirements are within the code to what the actual science says. So it's very clear where those recommendations and requirements came from. Enhancing the transparency of the code process by instituting, for example, the 60-day public comment period. And we're continuing in this project. We're learning even more about the importance of improving the transparency, and we're playing with some new techniques to try and enable people who aren't actually on the code development committee to have a greater say. And so if you go to NFAC's website and you look at the equine code, you can see that we've been implementing a survey tool to allow stakeholders to have a greater say in how the code is updated and what is really important. Now, that's not to undermine the integrity of the code development committee, but it's important to have that stakeholder buy-in if we want codes to be for people to know they have codes and for codes to be followed as well. But we also wanted to maintain what was working from the previous code process. And the primary, well, one of the, to me, the most important thing from that process was the collaborative nature. And did that work? How is this supposed to work? Oops, I went back, I went too far on that one. So the French is working, the English isn't. All right, too bad I don't speak French. Anyways, okay, so the collaborative approach of the code process promotes the concept that the codes are our national understanding of animal care requirements and recommended best practices, and also creates an environment for diverse perspectives to come together and build a common and sustainable direction forward on farmed animal care and welfare. And all of that active participation promotes buy-in. So we aren't asking our code representatives to just fill seats. We're asking them to really represent the organizations that they come from, such that those organizations then also are supportive of the codes. So we're building that common understanding around what's expected relative to farmed animal care in Canada. Change slides. I'm going to quit doing it myself. All right. So the code development team. There are two parts to the team now. We have the code development committee, which is facilitated by a code secretary, and all of our code secretaries are here today. The code committees, you can see the list of groups that are represented on each code committee. That broad representation and expertise on each code development committee also reflects the different and diverse views that we all have on farmed animal care and welfare out there. The consensus model is used for decision making, so there's no voting on the code development committee, which means we can spend hours sometimes on the smallest of issues, and I'm sure many people can relate to that from having been at code development committee meetings. But it's really important because we don't want to marginalize anyone in that code development committee to feel that because they were in the minority, their voice didn't count. Stakeholders have ownership of their respective codes through that active participation as well. And then there's the scientist committee. That's a new addition to the code process. It's facilitated by a research writer. And that team working together, the code development committee and the scientist committee, by working together, it makes it possible to identify evidence-based and practical solutions that address farm animal care concerns and also ensure that animal agriculture can be sustainable and meet market expectations as well. Next slide. Perfect. We've broken the code process down into 7 steps, and it takes about 2 years to complete a code. And the development process, next step, next slide, the industry must initiate the code development process. And this is a really important point. We don't drag anyone kicking and screaming to the code development committee table. Everyone comes of their own volition, and they come willingly. And it's very key if we're hoping or expecting that codes are going to be adhered to and we want people to come in the right spirit to the code development committee, that they do so willingly. So no one is forced to update their code. Every group that is doing so has done so because they saw value in it. The next step is that NFAC announces that the code is being updated. So that information is on NFAC's website, and probably many of you have received the press releases that have been put out whenever a code is being updated. And then the code development committee. It's the responsibility of the industry group to populate their code development committee, but they have guidelines for doing that. We're back still. Back on slide 7. Is that what I've got? Yes, that is. So while industry chooses the individuals on their code, they have to represent each of these groups, and they have to work with the national lead organizations in identifying the individuals that are going to be on their code development committee. Because again, we want each one of these groups to also have buy-in to the code process as part of that common understanding of farm animal care and welfare. So it's really important that the national organizations are involved in helping to identify their code reps, because they ultimately are going to have to stand behind this code as well. Next slide. Thank you. NFAC's job is to put together the scientist committee, and to do that, we go, generally, the three associations that we approach are the Canadian Society of Animal Science, the International Society for Applied Ethologists, and the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association. And when we approach those associations and say, bring us some names, tell us who needs to be on this particular code, what we're asking them to do is to identify individuals who are actively involved and engaged in research for that species, and ideally people whose names are synonymous with that species. So when you think of that person, you're thinking of that species, and that reflects some of the credibility that we're looking for in the scientist committee itself. And we're looking for broad representation on the scientist committee to ensure that we are also amongst our research committee representing the breadth of ways of looking at animal welfare. So whether it's primarily an animal health perspective, a feelings or affective state perspective, or a behavioral perspective on animal welfare. The Code Development Committee and the Scientist Committee work together to identify what the priority welfare issues are, and that exercise is usually quite interesting. We usually end up with a huge pile of things, and everyone has to whittle it down to 3 to 6 priority welfare issues, those issues that would most benefit from a review of the scientific literature. So first off, it has to be an area probably that has some research, and quite often it ends up being an area that is somewhat contentious as well. And so they have to whittle that down into a list that is manageable within a one-year time frame, because we are on a time limit. Next slide. The Code Development Committee... Actually, I missed a point there, and now I've just escaped my brain what it was. But anyways, it'll come back to me. The Code Development Committee then begins work on the code. So, yes, that's what it was. All those priority welfare issues that are still a priority but don't make it to the final list, it's not that they're ignored. They are addressed within the code. And so the Code Development Committee actually has a lot of work on its plate during the time that the Scientist Committee is doing its report, filling in and compiling the draft of the code relative to issues that didn't make it onto the Scientist Committee list. So the Scientist Committee does its priority welfare issues report, takes about 1 year, next slide, and then finally the Scientist Committee report, once they feel they've done their job, it goes to the Code Development Committee for review. The Code Development Committee ensures that the answers that were originally being posed were addressed. And one other key point on the Scientist Committee is the report does not make any recommendations. It only tells what the conclusions are based on the science. And it's really important that's the way things are, because science can only tell us what is. It can't tell us what ought to be. And the decision of what the ought to be needs to be made by the Code Development Committee, which more accurately reflects the broader societal perspectives that are out there. Certainly the researchers are a part of that Code Development Committee. The chair of the Scientist Committee sits on the Code Development Committee. So the research community is actively engaged in identifying the what ought to be, but they're one of several voices that are going to be deciding the what ought to be at that table. So that's a really key component of how our Scientist Committee works. Once the Scientist Committee report is okayed by the Code Development Committee, it goes for a peer review. So another layer of credibility added to what the report actually says. And the Code Development Committee at that point can use the Scientist Committee report to continue drafting the code. Next slide. In step 5, the final draft code, which takes probably another year after that, after the Scientist Committee report is received, the final draft code is submitted to NFAC. So this is when the Code Development Committee feels that it's done its job, it feels it has a good code in hand, and NFAC then makes it ready for a public comment period. And that is probably one of the, well, it's a really valuable addition to the code development process. At the same time that the code is made available for public comment, the Scientist Committee report is too. So anyone offering feedback on the code is able to see how the Scientist Committee report was used in the actual code itself. Next slide. From the public comment period is considered by the Code Development Committee, and they will make revisions as needed. And I have to say, when we did the dairy code, this was an extraordinary process, the public comment period. We were overwhelmed with the feedback. It was so positive to receive such diverse input from across the spectrum. It was also a huge challenge to compile all that feedback, but But I have to say that the code development committee, upon getting that feedback, was able to improve the code even further and end up with an even better final product. And so I really want to emphasize the importance of this public comment period, and some of you will know a few more reasons as to why I think it's important. It really was a valuable step in the whole process. Even though you have these great experts around the table, sometimes you still get additional value from having additional input from others who are going to look at the issues a little bit differently. The final code is then submitted to NFAC once the code development committee has done its final job. And then NFAC is responsible for publishing it, making it available on its website, and printing copies of the code. And then the hard work begins for industry, as dairy farmers are finding out, the efforts to ensure implementation of the code. And that is a multi-year process. It's ongoing, and it's something that does take time as well. Next slide. So, in order to have success, we need everyone to be actively participating around that code development committee table. They need to be collaborating. They need to be patient with each other. And they need to strive for consensus. And what's really, really cool in developing a code in this fashion, and something I think we experienced with the dairy code for sure, was that we also built long-term relationships. And that was really important as well. The stereotypes that people maybe had come to the table with originally were faded away, and we started to see what we actually had in common instead of always looking at what we have as differences. And when you start to build those relationships, then you can start working on what your differences are as well and chip away at those. Next slide. This is my last slide, and then Jeff can come on up. This slide for me represents industry's commitment to the codes of practice and to farmed animal care and welfare. I said that we don't drag anyone kicking and screaming to the table, so this was pretty extraordinary. We didn't know who was going to step up, and as you can see, we have 7 codes on the go. Yesterday was the poultry meat bird code orientation session, so that became number 7. We signed up on this project committing to finishing 5 codes and initiating 3 more. And we're aiming to have 6 finished by the end of this project that we think is actually feasible. And then as of this morning, we got an email from Egg Farmers of Canada who also now wish to update their code. So we're now going to be at 8 codes. So that really does demonstrate industry's commitment to farmed animal care and welfare. My final word, though, on this is we are doing this all through project funding, and it all ends December 31st, 2013. We do not have a long-term sustainable code process yet. And so my challenge to myself and to everyone here is if we are valuing our code development process, we need to work together to find a way to make sure that it is sustainable beyond 2013. Thank you.
Hi, how are you doing? Now, I'm way too frightened to touch this device here, so I'll just ask the man in the corner if you can move me onto the next slide, please. Can you hear me? I get the feel sort of, yeah, okay. I feel like I'm in a sound bubble too. Jackie mentioned the extent to which the present codes are science-informed, which I think is a real strength of them. And it certainly corresponds to how the governments view the way that we should be doing things. And it corresponds to what's happening at the international level, for example, like the OIE, the World Organization for Animal Health, which again insists that standards for animal welfare that are used in international trade be at least based on science. I thought I'd just do a quick SWOT or a quasi-SWOT analysis of the codes of practice, and particularly the extent to which we can use science to inform them. One of the strengths is that Canada actually has a relatively large scientific community working in animal welfare. What I did was I just made a quick count of all the number of scientists working in this area in various countries and divided that by the size of the population. And you can see that the Scandinavian countries are way better than anyone else, with 4.61 animal welfare scientists for every million people. But actually, Canada's not too bad. It's certainly equivalent to what's happening in most European countries. And you can see that it's way better than, for example, in the US, which has less than a quarter of a scientist for every million people. So we certainly have the scientific person power in Canada for being able to put these codes onto a reasonable scientific background. The other big advantage is that we scientists have actually developed quite close relationships with most of the other stakeholder groups in this area. Not only producer organizations, but animal welfare groups, consumer groups, and so forth. And that's what's interesting is that, and this is something that always surprises my colleagues in Europe, is how much the producer groups actually fund the research that gets done in Canada. And I've just put up a list of some of the organizations that have funded the work we've been doing, for example, on dairy cow welfare. And you can see it has dairy producer groups, has animal welfare groups. Valacta is a sort of an information provider to dairy farmers. And we have food retailers also putting in. So there's a close link between the research community in Canada and these stakeholder groups, which is, I think, is a real strength that we can build on. Another big advantage is that the scientists working here have actually a lot of experience with developing animal welfare standards in other contexts, particularly internationally. I mean, we have David Fraser, who's our international star, probably working with the OIE and the FAO, but most of the rest of us have also had experience with different international organizations developing animal welfare standards. So I think we're in a good position to make sure that Canadian standards correspond fairly well with international developments. So I think those are some of the main strengths. The last one, of course, is that we now have a national strategy in the form of NSERC for actually linking the research that is done with the actual practice on the farm. Now, there's one strength that I neglected to put in, which I have to mention. I think one of the real strengths that we have in Canada is having animal welfare organizations which are reasonable and which are prepared to sit down in the same room with industry groups and try and come to some sort of compromise position. I think that's a real strength that we have. And you notice that particularly when you see what's happening south of the border in the US of A, where things have become just so extreme that it's hard to see any real compromise developing. So I think we need to recognize that that's a real strength and that we need to do everything we can to protect that. Okay, what are the weaknesses? As the code committees discover, there's a hell of a lot of very important topics which just haven't been researched at all. A lot of the research that's been done in Europe has been done in Europe. I don't think that's such a problem for, say, poultry production, pork production, which is similar between Europe and North America. But it is a big problem with beef production because we have very different beef production in North America than in most European countries. So there's a real lack of research support for a lot of beef cattle issues. This is the complaint that we always make in research, that it's hard to get money, it's unpredictable, and it's erratic. The code committees make an effort to try and come up with some priorities for research. But unless the people who actually have the money take this on and decide to fund it, then a lot of these things just don't get done. And I think that is one of the issues that we need. If we are going to develop this as a strategy, we somehow need to find some way of linking in the funding of research with what's happening in this code development process. It's a big problem. The research is uneven across commodities. There's a hell of a lot done on dairy cows, for instance. Very much less done on beef cattle. I think probably poultry production is one of the worst funded, until recently at least. I think at one point we were down to sort of one person in all of Canada. I think that seems to be improving. But when you look at groups like equines or sheep, for instance, there's a real lack of research in certain areas. And I think the other thing is that if we want to be serious and we really want to develop an animal welfare assessment model, we need to recognize that we just simply don't have the infrastructure there. If all the groups, for example, decided suddenly, okay, we want to start assessing animal welfare, I don't think we could do it because we don't have anyone trained to be, you know, assessors in animal welfare. We don't really have the sort of technical expertise to start doing that compared to what the situation is in Canada. Okay? That one's not. Okay. Some of the possible opportunities. The codes of practice are a great way of getting the research that we do out into the industry. I think we all recognize that the lack of uptake of research by industry groups is a problem. It is challenging to transfer the results of research into the industry. So I think the codes of practice that we have are likely to be a very good way of doing that. It helps convince funding organizations that investing in animal welfare is worthwhile. And I think, again, that's probably something important to us. But, you know, I have to convince Ag Canada every year to give me a bit more money. And for them to do that, they have to see that there is actually some outcome for us doing it, that this actually does have some impact on the community at large. And I think the codes of practice are a way of showing that it is, in fact, worthwhile investing money into research in animal welfare because it is converted into something that the industry does actually use. We can help build a good network of research in farm animal welfare. I think we all tend to connect very well to each other, and I think this gives us an opportunity to build up closer links between producer groups, animal welfare groups, and researchers. Good possibilities of integrating what we're doing with international developments. I think we need to accept that most of the pushes tend to come from outside the country, but with our codes of practice, we have a good opportunity of making sure that what we do does in fact keep step with international developments, which of course is important for international trade and for industries like pork and beef, which sell so much of their products outside the country. And interestingly, I think there's a lot of business opportunities in developing animal welfare assessment infrastructure. And you can see this in that great land of capitalism there south in the border, where whole animal welfare assessment companies have started developing to actually start doing this welfare assessment. So I think people see there is actually money to be made in developing this, which is an interesting approach. Next. Okay, the threats. It is a real and present danger that the codes we're developing are going to be ignored. And that was, I think, probably the biggest complaint that people had about the old codes of practice, that we spent all this time and effort coming up with codes which then people just completely ignored. Now, that's true not only of the industry groups who don't take the requirements and recommendations on board, but it's also, I think, a danger with the animal welfare groups who, in their search to try and get more funding, can tend to take a more and more extreme point of view. So I think that's a real challenge that we need to recognize. We need to make sure that both sides of the debate do, in fact, take these codes to heart and adjust their policies to them. It's always a problem in research. People say, oh, well, let's do research on this, and then you do research on that, and then people say, well, we don't like the results, we won't take any notice of them. It's very difficult, I've noticed, for industry groups, the public, governments, animal welfare groups, and virtually everyone to adjust their deeply held beliefs in response to facts that show that their deeply held beliefs don't actually correspond to reality. So I think this is something that we do need to realize, that turning to science is risky because the results you get may not be what you want. There's a danger that we can misuse the science. I think science still has some degree of credibility among public and governments and different stakeholders, and it is seen to be objective and even-handed, so that when people do disagree, they tend to say, well, let's see what the science says. And again, I think it's very important that we maintain the credibility of researchers and scientists. And in fact, I think NFAC has done a very good job with the Sciences Committee, where it's been clear that the scientists will operate independently of the other stakeholder groups, and that the results of the reviews will be made public. So if the industry groups ignore them or the animal welfare groups ignore them, then it's obvious for everyone to see. So I think it's important to recognise that that aura of scientific objectivity is a strength that we have, and that it is important to make sure that we maintain that. It's a danger that people are going to see the codes of the final solution. I think animal welfare is one of these issues like the environment and human safety, that the bar just keeps going higher and higher and higher, and that we just need to recognise that this is just going to be the first step in the way and that it's going to keep going. And I think probably the last danger, which again I think is a real one, is that we're simply going to be overtaken by competing countries. And I think this is particularly true of South America. I went to a scientific conference on cattle veterinary science in Chile. And I was just amazed how much interest there is in animal welfare in South American countries. The reason they're interested, of course, is that they want to feed. You know, we talk about we're going to feed the world, but they think they're going to feed the world. And they can probably feed the world much cheaper than we can do it. And they see that if they're going to have to export food to Europe or even to North America, it's going to be important for their industries to show that they are meeting these international standards. So I think it's a real danger that unless we take this seriously, that our competing countries are in fact going to overtake us on this way. And I think this is the last slide. Yeah, Jackie asked me to speak on this slide. There's this very interesting African proverb: if you want to go fast, travel alone, but if you want to go far, travel together. I don't think that's a picture of Africa. It's probably even a picture of Jackie Wetbrock herself up in the North Pole, somewhere in Alberta, showing us the importance of all pulling in the same direction if you're in difficult and dangerous terrain. So with that, I'll end. Thank you.
We do have time for questions, and I'd like to entertain some. Bill, Jackie, can you? Who are you directing this to, Bill? Say your name and.
Bill DeMeyer, Horse Welfare Alliance of Canada. Oh, thank you very much. I guess I don't have to shout. I guess this is a question for Jackie, resultant from Jeff's comments. We should not be so proud as to contain this great work within the borders of Canada. You made a presentation in the UK with respect to our code work. That brought some results. I'm pleased to tell you that there was a reference made in an inquiry for the sale of animals to our codes, and the fact that we are developing, they said developing, I say we're redeveloping our codes, and so it's going to affect the foreign markets. We need to be, as Jeff said, proud to say that we're close. So the question is, what is NFAC going to do about promoting to the world that we are establishing comprehensive and inclusive codes and hoping that our animal industry participants will adhere to them, because they are not regulations at this time. I hope that they will be included in some way in regulation later. But the question is, what are we doing to tell the countries around the world and to help our foreign markets?
Well, one of the activities that we have through this project is outreach and promotion. And so to the best extent that we are able, we are trying to reach out by ensuring that we're out there at international events. And as you mentioned, I didn't actually do a presentation, but we did have a poster presentation on the code process at a conference in the UK this year. And also, you know, we rely on our partners around the NFAC table to help us to get this word out as well. NFAC is a very small organization, and we do have limited human resource. So we do rely on our partners to help us in that regard as well. And this year, we can thank the Canadian Food Inspection Agency for inviting NFAC to be a part of the Canadian delegation to the OIE's General Assembly. And so that was another opportunity for us to have those one-on-one conversations with people in the international environment as to what NFAC is doing on its codes, the perspective that we're taking, this collaborative approach, how we do work very hard to sit together with all stakeholders around the table and build relationships that are going to lead to improvements in farm animal care. So it's opportunities like that that we work to take advantage of. We also, and I have to say thanks again to AgriFlexibility for the funding that they've given us, because it has been a real opportunity to develop some of the communications materials that we need in order to effectively communicate about what we are doing. And so, you know, the announcement on the 2011 NFAC Achievements brochure, that just came out in time for this conference. The NFAC code brochure, code of practice brochure, those are the kinds of things that we need to be able to utilize to spread the word, and even our website. So certainly this project, I'm hoping, is going to help us launch a lot of those international connections that we need to communicate as to what we are doing here in Canada. And then there's a question up front.
Neil Jotham, Fur Institute of Canada. I just wondered how well the codes are being used or are used at all in any of the discussions related to the veterinary agreement between Canada and the EU.
I don't think I can actually answer that question because I'm not privy to the discussions that are happening between Canada and the EU. I don't know if there's anyone else in this room who could speak to that.
No, but I think whatever, if we're going to use codes for anything, we have to be able to convince people that producers are, in fact, following the codes. And I think that's one of the big things we lack at the moment, that NFAC is trying to fill with the animal care assessment model. You know, we need to be able to tell, you know, we need to show, to demonstrate that people, that the producers do follow the codes. And that's always been the problem that we've had up till now.
It is, of course, addresses the gentleman's question that it's another way of outreaching about our code.
Lady in the raceway.
I probably don't need
the microphone.
Oh, but for translation, you do.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. Just a comment. Am I doing this right? Oh, Jane Goodridge, working with the Manitoba pork producers on the sow conversion project from stalls to group sow housing. And what I've noticed, I see a lot of things in the media about how bad animal agriculture is. And I often go to meetings with like-minded people that are kind of the converted, but we're not taking enough of the message out in a public way. There's a very horrible commercial on CTV right now about sow stalls. But there's nothing from our industry saying this is in a commercial or a public forum, getting to those urban populations that have no connection with agriculture on what our industry is doing, like these codes, these welfare, like voluntarily updating these things is something we need to get out to the city population in the same type of manner that these other people are getting the negative message out, that this is what we're doing. This is a proactive thing. Nobody's forcing us to do it. It's because we are animal welfareists too, and we do care. Nobody's hearing our side of the message. Is there any way or any movement towards sort of taking this more out to the people that we need to hear? There's a lot of fence sitters that when I talk, come up to me and ask about the sow stalls, and I say, well, we're already doing that. We're already moving forward on that. We're already going to group sow housing. And their retort is always, well, why aren't you guys saying anything? Why isn't that message getting out there?
Well, NFAC does not speak on behalf of any particular industry group. So if we're talking about any specific issue...
Yeah,
collectively, I mean, yeah, NFAC has really been working internal up until now with the partners that it has amongst itself to ensure that we're all on the same page, and it's important that we're all on the same page first and that we have a strong argument and a strong story before we go out into the public and start talking to the public about what it is that we're doing. But I do think that there are other initiatives out there that are looking exactly at what you're talking about in terms of agricultural advocacy and having that positive story be told. NFAC has focused most of its energies around ensuring that we do have the positive story. And I think there, David had a comment you were saying?
I just want to add on that. But again, I think that shows the real importance of being able to show to people that farmers are complying with these things, because the problem with the situation we're in, anybody can say farmers are doing anything in Canada, and we can't really contradict it. I mean, I know they probably don't, but, you know, we can't say, well, X percent of Canadian pork producers no longer use stalls, because we just don't know. You know, so that's what I mean. I think it's really important to be able to actually show that farmers are, in fact, complying with the standards.
I was just going to comment on the previous question from Bill. Oh, I'm David Truss, Agriculture Canada. There we go. Got that out of the way, Ron. Just further to the question from Bill, there are several different levels in which what Canada does would be relayed to other countries. And of course, what he's asking, some of it may be the public level, some of it may be with industry, and some may be with governments. But there also is the international multilateral fora, and the OIE is the primary one. And when it comes to animal welfare issues, the OIE is the forum where Canada is a very active participant. It was mentioned that David Fraser, of course, is on the Permanent Animal Welfare Working Group with the OIE. But when any of the new codes are being developed or the old codes are being revised, Canada actively participates. There is an opportunity for all of the groups to comment, to propose ways to change and to improve those international codes as well. So not only is it important to advance the issue of animal welfare here in Canada, but around the world, because at one point, too, it may factor into trade issues. And certainly on the side, it is something we in the government are always watching out for. So also bilaterally, we would participate and comment to other countries on various issues that touch on the animal welfare side. But at the OIE, Brian Evans is the Chief Veterinary Officer for Canada. He's a great ambassador for Canada, and he, too, certainly makes known to other countries the good things Canada is doing.
Thanks. We have time for one more, if there is any more. Over here.
Jack Gordonis, Canadian Hatching Producers. Just to further to the first gentleman's question, his question was whether NFAC could regulate. I think there was some discussion on whether that could be completed to make certain it happens. What's your thoughts around that?
Whether NFAC would regulate?
It's got to be done. How do we do it?
Well, it won't be NFAC that's doing any kind of regulation. And as I said in one of my slides, I mean... research is showing that the best way to improve animal care is by doing effective information extension. And regulation is there for, and that's a government, that's a government jurisdiction. Regulation is there to catch the bottom dwellers. Most people, and that is really, I mean, and when I say information extension, that's not an easy job. I mean, Jeff and Anne-Marie are doing a lot of work with the dairy industry around extension. And it's not easy to do effective information extension, and that's our challenge. But that is truly the best way to ensure improvements in animal care by far. And there's actually research to back that up. It's science-based.